Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is Denise Gagne coming at you from the conference room of the University Business Center in Seattle, Washington.
Room 31, represent.
I'm here with the esteemed Noah Weil. He's here to lead the first joint podcast in our efforts before we join forces. He told me he's going to lead the discussion in a very spirited way, and I'm anxious to know what's on the agenda. Noah.
It'll be like a ghost. That's how I do my spirited things. I move objects, and I create a chilling feeling.
You do look like a bearded Casper. I'll give you that. Let's move on from ghosts and talk about something lighthearted, maybe incarceration. Maybe we can share some stories about our times that we've spent visiting clients in custody. I've done a whole lot of that this week, and last week and this week in particular, I've had a lot of negative experience with jail guards. So let's just pick it up a notch and talk about something a little light and fun.
Okay. Well, why, for the people who are listening, most of whom aren't lawyers, why do you need to go to the jails to visit your clients?
There are many reasons why I might need to go to the jail to visit clients. Most often, it's because my clients cannot meet the bail requirements and they are held in custody as their cases are pending. Occasionally, I visit clients post-sentencing, if there's been a guilty plea or if there's been a jury verdict and the judge sentences them to jail, then I'll go visit them while they're in custody at the end of their case. But most often, it's at the beginning of their case.
And when lawyers and defendants meet at the jail, what does that look like? What are you guys talking about? What's the goals of that meeting?
Generally, it starts with an introduction. Sometimes when I'm doing the public defense cases, I've received the case on assignment from the Office of Public Defense. I've received an electronic copy of the police report, and I know a little bit about the facts of the case. I know about the person's history because I've received a summary of their, at least Washington State, criminal history. So I start out with an introduction. Hi, I'm your lawyer, which can go one of two ways. Sometimes people are happy to see me, relieved that I'm there. Sometimes people act as if I'm their assigned counselor means I am a public pretender and they've been through the system and they know better than me. So,
do you think that it's the same attitude towards all public defenders or specifically you, and you're known in the jails as someone who can't do the job?
I've been told many times and in many different circumstances that my reputation precedes me, so it's hard to really know in this circumstance if it's, you know, jailhouse scribbles or if it's just a general attitude.
Now, the process of getting into the jail, it's not that you just walk in, find their cell door, and just go on through, right? There's a lot of hurdles to get in there?
Yes.
What are they?
Depending on what jurisdiction you're in, just in the last week, I've been to three different jurisdictions. I've been to the King County Jail, which is by far, in my opinion, the worst hellhole, and I wouldn't wish my worst enemy to be forced to step foot in there. I also went to the Issaquah Jail, which was sort of a joke, just in terms of security, and they didn't even have me go through a metal detector. And then there was a regional justice center down at the RJC. At the King County Jail, they make the defense attorneys, if we want to be granted the privilege to bring in our cell phones, we have to go through a special application process. forget that each and every prosecutor who walks through those doors is allowed to bring in their cell phone and just fuck around on Facebook for 3 straight hours as they handle the jail calendar, defense attorneys can't be trusted, and we have to go through an application process before we're allowed to bring our cell phones into the jail.
Well, Denise, don't forget, the prosecutors have a card that they are issued by the city or the county that says you're a prosecutor. So they have gone through the application process, and then they get their picture printed on a card, and they wave it to the guard, and the guard's like, well, that's all I need to see.
Yeah, that's not an application process.
Defense attorneys don't have a card, so what else can they do?
I do have a card. I have a Washington State Bar Association card.
Anybody can get those. They give those out like candy.
A 20-page application process when I sat down to even just sit for the bar exam, and they had to check into my moral and ethical fitness. So I don't know why the prosecutors get special privilege, but I'm a whole lot of butthurt about it.
Okay. So you want to go in. You get to keep your cell phone once you go through the application process. Is there any other steps?
Go through the metal detector, put all of my items, my laptop and my purse on the filthy screening belt, walk through. Inevitably, it goes off because my cheap shoes or whatever, the metal in my bra, activates it. And then I'm treated like I'm a friggin' criminal. Walk back through, take off your shoes, walk back through, do this, walk back through, do a cartwheel.
Now, you said take off your shoes. King County Jail is known for the cleanliness of their floors. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. They are. They have the prisoners kind of come out front one by one each and every day and scrub the floors with a toothbrush. Either that or each and every person, citizen of the city of Seattle who, you know, might have issues, has walked through or crawled through or done whatever through that metal detector, and it's not a good place for somebody who is a germaphobe like myself to be told that I need to remove my shoes when I'm not wearing any socks. So I got into a little bit of a tiff with the jail guards at King County Jail a couple weeks ago and basically told them to fuck off. And
how'd that go?
It didn't go in my favor.
So, you know, some of the people listening might be future clients or future people who are just going to be in jail. Odds are 75% of the people listening will be in jail at some point the next year. Can we advise them to tell the jail guards to?
I would not recommend. I guess if we're going to be talking about privilege and I'm all butthurt that the prosecutors get a better privilege than me, I wouldn't recommend that the average citizen walk through and tell the jail guards to fuck off, because at least I've got a bar card and I can say that I have a constitutional right to meet with my client, but there aren't any rights afforded to particular citizens to come visit the jail at any given time. So, duly noted, I would not recommend to our listeners that they tell the jail guards to fuck off.
I guess we can just see how it plays out. We can get some that say fuck off and some that don't. We'll just get some anecdotes back.
Look, I'm not the boss of you. You do what you want to do. I'm not trying to be here to tell you how to live your life.
Don't leave the jail. That one we'll give you some strong advice about. Once you're in jail, trying to leave until they let you out. But otherwise, do what you need to do. Now, it's funny, Denise, that you mentioned the, privilege of prosecutors and how they, are above the law, essentially, because I believe my notes indicate that you used to be a prosecutor.
Oh, Noah, funny. I forgot that I'd mentioned that.
Yeah. Yes. So I was mentioning some people that you used to be a prosecutor, asking for questions because you're a guest on my show. And the number one question was, how do you live with yourself? How can you face yourself in the mirror knowing your soul is so dark?
Therapy. It's been years of therapy.
Okay. That's understandable completely. But why don't you tell us kind of your career arc, how you got into that field, what you were doing before then, why that appealed to you, what it was like working there, that kind of thing.
All right. Well, I started in between my second and third year of law schools. In Washington, you can actually practice law with a limited license. They have a Rule 9 license here. So I started as an intern there, a Rule 9 legal intern between my second and third years of law school. It wasn't something I was drawn to. It wasn't something I felt passionate about. It wasn't something that I really, cared about, except that they were one of the few internships that offered payment for your services. So usually when you're doing legal work during your 1L, 2L, and 3L years, it's volunteering your time. I was not in a position where I could afford to volunteer my time, so I really needed a job with somebody who was willing to pay me. And for whatever reason, the city attorney's office was willing to pay me. So I started there, enjoyed my time, liked being in court, and was lucky enough that when I finished law school and passed the bar, there was a woman who was going on maternity leave. So I started off on just a 3-month contract, and then it went from there. Another position opened up, and I told myself, I'm not going to stay here any longer than 5 years.
You don't need to apologize so much for your prosecutor. I was giving you a hard time.
I'm sorry. I knew from the beginning that I was just taking evil steps, but I promised myself it would be a quick evil internship. But
so I'll tell you, the first few episodes of this has been talking about cases I've done and how I've worked them up and prepared and so on. I don't think many people know how prosecutors handle cases. So when you get a file as a prosecutor, what's your practice? How does that work in your office?
It was different depending on the unit that you were in. When I was in the domestic violence unit for 2.5 years, they do what's called horizontal prosecution, meaning that the same prosecutor handles the case from beginning to end, meaning the moment that the police report is faxed from the police department to the city attorney's office. If I'm assigned to that particular caseload, at the time I was covering letters L through R, I would read the police report, I would make the filing decision, I would negotiate the case at the pretrial stage, and if there wasn't a resolution to be found, then I would be the trial attorney on the case. That's not how it works in any of the other departments. That's special to the domestic violence unit. In the other departments, you're assigned either to the filing unit, there are 4 prosecutors there, and the cases that they came in were just divided evenly, and they'd sit on a prosecutor's desk for anywhere from 24 hours to 8 months before a filing decision was made. If you were on the trial prosecutor track, then you would both negotiate cases and handle cases at trial once they were set for trial.
Were there particular cases you really liked doing or really didn't like doing as a prosecutor?
I liked doing DUIs, mostly because drunk people are really fucking funny, and we'd have the best sort of stories to discuss in the lunchroom.
So, yeah, lots of police reports from people who were drunk and doing dumb things?
Yeah, just drunk people throwing up, drunk people, you know, dropping trow and pooping on the officer's shoe, just all sorts of funny, crazy, hilarious stuff that drunk people do. But Noah, I know that you used to be, you've probably talked about this before, when you were a public defender, did you have a favorite kind of case to represent or a case to work on? How would you work up your cases?
I have never thought about a favorite case. I didn't like DUIs because they usually involve some pretty complex issues involving, you know, machine operations and Widmark's formula and things like that. I always liked the domestic violence cases because I enjoy working with people, and it was always a very human interaction. And the police reports were always so different than what the people who were actually there would say. And it was just fun to get to the heart of that and to see sometimes the victims would recant or say, I was a contributor to it, and sometimes they would escalate. No, he got worse. I didn't mention the fact that, you know, he also broke my vase and he also, you know, snapped our baby's crib in half on his knee and things of that nature. And it was really fun just like kind of sifting, getting that his version, her version, and then the truth somewhere in the middle and discovering that. I've always enjoyed that process. But you're right. I was a public defender and you were a prosecutor at the time. And so we would sometimes interact on cases. And you were known in my office as D. Nice, partially because that's the spelling of your name, because your parents don't know how to spell Denise correctly, but also because you were among the more pleasant prosecutors. You seemed reasonable to work with, and you were willing to look at things with, I guess, perspective, as we would say. Do you agree with that? Did you think you were nice?
I tried to be nice.
And did that match the office, the philosophy of the office, your other colleagues at the time? Did you feel like an outlier?
I didn't feel like an outlier, but I think I was aware that I was sort of one of the more easygoing or flexible when it came to negotiations. And sort of my background philosophy when I realized it was going to be not just an internship, but hey, I'm going to take this on as a career for a bit, it was important to me generally important to me that I made sure that I treated everybody who came through the system with respect and with dignity. Just because they were charged with crimes didn't mean that they were, that there was something evil about them. And I wanted to, when I first started and I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, my goal was to make sure that I treated everybody as if they were my brother. My brother, I'm not sure if I've told you, had sort of a sordid past. So it was lucky that he didn't end up incarcerated himself, but I wanted to find the humanity in whoever was before me and treat them in the way that I would want somebody to treat my brother if he had ever been picked up during any of his heydays. So I don't know if I told you this, but after I was 5 years in.
Revelations, people.
Yes, these are deep, deep secrets I'm sharing now.
Pete Holmes smokes weed? What?
They let me have an intern myself after I had been there for 5 years, which felt kind of crazy to me because I still didn't really know what I was doing. But they gave me an intern, and the first day that we sat down with the intern, and he was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and had out his legal pad and wanted to know sort of my expectations, and I broke them down that it was fine with me if he lost cases. It was fine with me if he didn't win any cases, period. What I wanted him to do was to look people in the eye at arraignment hearings. I wanted him to treat the court with respect, and I wanted him to treat every defendant who was in front of him with the respect that he would want to be afforded if he found himself in the red jumpsuit one day. And he looked, I got this serious look from him, and he was kind of a serious dude, but I thought at the time, there's no way this guy's got tears in his eyes. This is weird. This is weird. Let's move on. Maybe I'm getting too serious. And at the end of his tenure with us, I actually went out to dinner. My husband and I went out to dinner with he and his wife, and he shared with me the reason that he'd gotten sort of choked up when I told him that was because his wife's brother, his brother-in-law, had actually committed suicide when he was in custody, and that he had sort of been through the system and was disheartened and had been treated just like basically a piece of shit by everyone he came into contact at the jail, in the courthouse. So I think those probably were tears I saw in his eyes.
And that young man was Justice Antonin Scalia, who learned some compassion that day and then
exactly.
Promptly forgot it.
Yes.
Well, that's nice. I think we know the answer, that not all prosecutors perhaps feel the same way or effectuates that kind of practice.
Yeah, and I think there's just sort of a personality defect with a lot of people who go into the practice of law, period. And then I think there's an added defect for people who decide that they're going to make a career out of incarcerating people. It's not all by any means, but I think that there are some egos and there's some power trips and there's a lot of reasons that people who are given that limited amount of power think that it means much more than it does.
What do prosecutors think of defense attorneys?
I think it just depends, again, on the person. I think, in general, mostly, prosecutors think that we're all, that there's space for us to all be ethical, and there's space for us to all just kind of play ball and get along. We recognize that we're both playing the same game of chess. Let's just follow the rules, and everything will fall into place. There are some prosecutors who think that you must be evil if you're a defense attorney, that there must be something, you know, deficient in your personality if you've decided that's what you're going to do with your living, is to defend people who are out there committing heinous crimes.
I wouldn't agree with the evil part. I might agree with the defect somewhere mentally,
yes,
or maybe in the soul. I don't know. It's a good question.
When you were at the public defender's office, was there a overall sentiment, like a feeling towards the prosecutor's office, or was it?
So it's interesting because there was two camps basically about that. There was one camp who was, we see these people every day at the office. Let's, you know, we have different goals sometimes. Sometimes we don't. Let's try to be conciliatory, or not conciliatory, but professional. Let's, you know, make sure that we're all working together. Sometimes we can't agree, but if there's a way, we can be friendly towards each other. They have a role to play. There was never a sense of prosecutors are going anywhere. So it was just a necessary evil. So it was just a question of how to handle that. That was one camp. And the other camp was like, look, we see them every day, but they are adversaries. They are working against our clients' interests. They're diametrically opposed to what we stand for, which is accountability and so on and so forth. And, you know, if we can make deals, great, but let's not sacrifice anything for our clients' interests. And let's just remember that they have their own interests that don't reflect ours. And I think both camps have a point. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really about individual. Some prosecutors, we call them true believers. They don't care about the history. They don't care about the story. They don't care about the bad facts. They just see somebody, they assume they commit a crime, and they've got to go down as hard as possible. And some prosecutors, and again, you were known in the office as having some perspective, do think about the bigger picture and the bigger implications of what's going on. And those prosecutors you can work with. And the ones you can't, then you go to bat and you make them prove your case, make them work.
Mm-hmm. I remember being in a courtroom with a courtroom assignment during my DV tenure, and the DV prosecutors at the time, ACA, they assigned two specific defense attorneys to the courtroom where I was assigned with two prosecutors. So we were in court with the same defense attorneys, the same two prosecutors, day in and day out for a year straight. It was adversarial, but it was very cordial, and it was fun, honestly, sometimes when the courtroom was clear and it was just the judge and the bailiff, the two prosecutors and the two defense attorneys were some of my best memories. But I remember a couple times the defense attorneys who I would grab drinks with at happy hour, who I would be invited to see socially on the weekends, would tell me during trial, "I don't want my client to see me being nice to you. I don't want him to get the wrong idea." And I understood, and I never took it personal, and that made sense to me, but it's just sort of interesting inside perspective to know that.
It's something we talk about at public defense forums about if the client, some of these people have never had gotten a break from the government, and some have mental health issues, which includes spikes of paranoia. And there have been some clients where I would say, look, I'm going to go talk to the prosecutor. I'm going to be friendly. I'm going to tell a joke. I'm going to clap him on the back. Don't think that I'm selling you out. I'm just doing it because I'm trying to get the best deal for you. And this is how I think the best way to do it is to be friendly rather than puff up my chest and kick sand at his feet. But don't worry. I'm on your side. And some clients would say, yeah, of course you are. I understand. And some would say, I really appreciate you letting me know that. And yeah, you've got to be aware of the perspective of what you're doing with the opposing side. I think that's a good point. My personal philosophy is if you can be friendly with them, great. But back in law school, I had an ethics professor, and his number one mantra was, who's your client? Remember who your client is. All your duties of loyalty and ethics revolve around knowing who your client is. And your client as a defense attorney is not to the system. It's not to the prosecutor. It's not to professionalism. It's to your client. You're one individual person who needs you as an advocate. And if you can be professional and cooperative and all the rest of it while maintaining your ethical duties to your client, great. But it's clear if you need to be aggressive and adversarial, that's much better than in any way sacrificing your client's interests.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I really think it's a case-by-case thing. Do you feel like your time at the prosecutor's office makes you a better attorney now?
I think it gives me better perspective on what might work with negotiations. I feel like I'm a much better attorney as a defense attorney. I think that the expectations on me when I was a prosecutor, honestly, were fairly low. I could walk into court with a bin full of 60 files, not having actually reviewed them before court.
Don't you hate when that happens now?
I hate when that happens now, but I did it. I did it when I was a prosecutor. The caseload was large. I got lazy, whatever it was, blah, blah, blah. And I never felt a strong pressure that something bad would happen, even if I lost a case. But the opposite is true now. I feel like if I ever walked into court and I didn't know the facts inside out of each and every case, if I didn't know exactly what moment bail was established, if I didn't know how many pretrial hearings we'd been through, if I wasn't able to answer the court when it asked what is the current speedy trial expiration, that I'm, you know, not representing my client zealously. So I feel much more prepared. And I also feel like the stakes are really high now, and that if I'm not researching in depth each and every possible issue that might come up at trial, then I'm potentially failing my client in a really significant way because the stakes are high. And even if it is just a mandatory 24 hours, in jail, that's 24 hours of liberty that my client will never get back. And the humiliation of being booked into jail and that whole process and having your name appear on the booking website, it's a big deal to somebody who has never been through the system, and it's not something that I take lightly at all. So I feel much more stressed, but I also feel a lot smarter as a defense attorney because there's much more that's expected of me.
The JAG Corp, the Judge Advocate General, the military lawyers, you're not allowed to be a defense JAG until you've been a prosecutor. You have to be a prosecutor first. And the reason is, if you screw up as a prosecutor, it's a lot less heinous than screwing up as a defense attorney.
Yep.
So I certainly appreciate what you're saying, that the stakes are higher as defense attorney. More rewarding, potentially, too.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing that person go free, that especially innocent ones, it's a heady feeling.
Do you like the experience of private practice more or less than your experience as a public defender?
There are pluses and minuses to both. What I appreciate most as private counsel is having the time to focus on cases. When I was a public defender, I had 100 files, and it was hard to give each and every client the same amount of attention that it deserved. And now I have fewer. I can really focus on one aspect and follow a trail to the end. I also appreciate that I have a more flexible schedule in the sense of, if I need to take a day off, I can do that without a lot of people jumping through a lot of hoops to accommodate mm-hmm. that. When my daughter was born last year, being able to take some, basically go to halftime in the first few months of her life was really nice and good for the family. And it just wouldn't have been possible as a public defender. I'm also rich. Super rich now.
I'm rich, bitch. Yeah. It's awesome.
I'll leave that out. I'm not rich. I wouldn't want to lie. Why don't you tell us now about leaving the office and setting up your own private practice?
Yeah, it was sort of a scary ordeal when I made the decision. It was a pretty quick and immediate the moment that I knew I wanted to leave, I was prepared to give notice, and it was a pretty political office, and there was just some political drama, and I wanted out. And I called my then fiance at the time and said, I'm going to quit my job. And he said, whoa, hey.
I'm used to a certain lifestyle, and you are jeopardizing that.
He said, should we talk about this? Maybe tonight when you get home? Because it was about 10:30 in the morning. I said, yeah. We can talk about it, but I'm quitting my fucking job.
We can talk about it. I have sent a pretty scathing letter to my bosses, and also made a small mess on some of their desks.
Yes, I may have already, though not technically, but sort of metaphorically, given my notice. So I did. I gave my notice the next day and found out about a week after I gave notice that I was pregnant. So I was starting a business, newly pregnant and scared absolutely shitless, because not only I wasn't at least changing areas of law, but I was doing the complete opposite and trying to start a practice.
And the father was an open question at this point, right?
You know, maybe I should go into family law and learn how to do paternity. I don't know. But yeah, it was scary. It was really scary. But I started out, I got lots of good advice from people who were mentoring me, one by the name of Noah Weil. I remember buying you a cup of coffee when we were at the Columbia Tower together. You had started your practice maybe a year by that point.
2011?
I think very end of 2011 was when I gave my notice.
Okay.
Yeah.
I started at the very beginning.
So I met with you. I met with half a dozen other defense attorneys who gave me good advice on what to do during that kind of first year of practice and tips on how to keep overhead low. So that's what I did.
Don't have a baby. Whatever you do, don't have a baby.
Don't try to take time off during this first year, because it's going to be really important that you just keep your nose to the ground.
I remember that
hustle,
meeting.
Hustle, hustle, hustle.
I remember that meeting, how stressed you were. You were drinking a lot of wine. Really. Just your nerves are
shot. Shots. So first year, I stayed in a virtual office, and overhead was really low. It was about $150 a month. And I would meet with clients there in the virtual office, and we'd meet in the conference room, and I would have all the appearances of a big, beautiful, fancy firm downtown on the 32nd floor.
Little did they know.
There was one client who said, "This is a virtual office, isn't it?" And I chuckled and I said, "It sure is."
You chuckled and said, "Get out."
You're fired.
I'm going to make sure you go to prison, sir.
See this case file? It's burning.
Was there weird interactions with your former colleagues because now you're on the other side of the aisle?
It was a little bit. Like the first time I would run into some of my buddies in court, they would kind of give me a look that said, "Oh, I don't want to do this with you. Oh, I don't want to fight with you." But there's not been really anything that sticks out as a unpleasant experience. There was one prosecutor who gave me a little bit of grief, but I remember being butthurt about it for a little bit, but don't remember why.
It's part of the game.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of former prosecutors that are now defense attorneys.
Yeah.
It does happen.
Yeah.
Do you think your former career gives you any cachet or gives you any status? Maybe for marketing, but also just when judges or other prosecutors learn about it, that they get it like a different perspective?
Maybe. I mean, I think that I do have credibility in Seattle Municipal Court because I've been appearing in front of those judges for almost 9 years now. So I don't think it's necessarily that I was formerly a prosecutor. It's just the fact that I've stepped foot through those doors and almost on a daily basis been in there for the last 9 years. When I go to different jurisdictions, nobody knows who I am. Nobody gives a shit that I was formerly a prosecutor. And when I was a prosecutor, I sort of resented when people would bring it up during negotiations. It felt to me a little slimy sometimes when they would try to bring it in. So I try pretty hard not to do that. But if we're standing in line waiting to negotiate with the prosecutor and somebody outs me as a former prosecutor, I feel like that's a better way. If somebody outs me and gives me an in rather than me being slimy and trying to tell the prosecutor, "I used to be one of you." Feels cheesy.
So when you were a prosecutor, some defense attorneys would say, "Oh, I used to be a prosecutor too.
Absolutely.
Let's see what we can do for this client here."
Yes. It felt like there was always a way to, an attempt to let me know. And maybe it was towards the end of my tenure there. I remember feeling very just skeptical of everything. I just thought everybody was full of bull. I thought the judges were full of bull. I thought colleagues were full of bull. I thought defendants who said, "You know, Your Honor, I need out of custody because my grandma died." I'm like, I'm looking at the case file and it says, "Your grandma died 2 weeks ago." This can't be right. I just didn't believe anything anybody was saying. And it was a good thing I got out when I did.
One thing I learned at the public defender's office is that mouthwash contains alcohol. And sometimes people have a positive ear analysis because they're just really into oral hygiene.
Yes.
And that just came up a lot. And I really appreciate, you know, fresh breath.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys did too.
And I think they probably were swallowing it by the gallon to get to the, you know, alleged.
They must have had like some kind of garlicky lunch because they needed to cleanse that.
They were vigilant, yeah.
Pretty hardcore.
Maybe I'll just say they were vigilant.
It's tough, right? How do you then, or how do you now, sift through what might not be the truth or might not be completely accurate to kind of accomplish what you want to accomplish?
Maybe it's that I'm still fairly new because I've been doing this now as a defense attorney for only 3.5 years, that I don't think I've directly confronted a client just point blank, "Hey, this is bullshit and this is why I know this is bullshit," because at least for me and just sort of the way my personality works, I don't think that's going to lead to a good resolve. I prefer with my clients to help them get to that point, and I'll show them things and I'll tell them, "I understand why you're saying this, but here's what I expect the prosecutor is going to do to help convince the jury that's not true. Let's take a look at this video together that shows you doing A, B, and C, which is what you just told me exactly you did not do."
I think that a lot of civilians, people that don't have the legal training, or dummos, as we call them in the field,
mm-hmm.
Think that the role of the defense attorney is to find out what happens. And if they're innocent, yeah, it's great that you're there. But if they're actually guilty, you kind of step aside and let nature take its course. And that's not the case.
No, absolutely not.
Not the case. But
absolutely not.
Do you think that defense attorneys have a moral or professional obligation to kind of learn about the truth of what happened and do something with that information for their case? confronting, basically asking the client or getting the client to admit what actually happened?
I honestly think that depends on the nature of the charge. Sometimes when it's a he said, she said, and there may be a gray area, sometimes I do ask pointed questions. When it's, for example, a DUI, and there's a breath test with a 0.15, I don't ask my client, how much did you have to drink, how many shots, how much alcohol. Even if the truth is that they were wasted, it doesn't impact the work that I'm going to do on the case. And sometimes I've told clients point blank, I don't want to know how much you had to drink beforehand, because if the time comes and I need you to testify, it might not be good for me to know the one thing today and have you reveal a different thing down the road. So I'm not going to talk to you about the facts of the case that led up to when you got behind the wheel. But I do want to talk about your recollection of the stop, your interaction with the officer, what field sobriety tests you were asked to do, etc. So that I want to contradict potentially those parts of the police report, but I don't actually want to know the truth of how drunk they were.
Do you think that's a problem, that maybe the person was drunk driving, but also the cop pulled him over because he was black or something? There's a conflict there, right? There's two bad things. And the defense attorney says he shouldn't have been arrested, even though he's guilty. He shouldn't be going to jail for this. The charges should be thrown out. Yeah, what do you think about that?
I feel strongly that the government should not intrude on our affairs, and that the worst, whatever, you know, the worst crime that's committed there is one of prejudice or one of pretext or one of a government overreach. And I have no problem whatsoever passing judgment on that overreach and turning a blind eye to a client who may have been driving a little drunk. No problem whatsoever.
There was an article I read yesterday, actually, that the New Orleans public defender in Louisiana said that their office was massively, massively underfunded, and they were getting a third of the funds that the prosecutor's office was, and that they would take serious mandatory life sentence felonies with basically no prep and do their best with them. And they were saying that defense attorneys are one of the last defenses against police overreach and helping stem police misconduct. Do you agree with that?
I agree wholeheartedly, absolutely. And it scares me in places like Louisiana and the South, where I think their clients probably are at much greater risk for government overreach. We have a pretty liberal city here, and I think a pretty, for the most part, a pretty smart and fair judiciary, but I don't think that's true everywhere. And I don't think that's true, especially with law enforcement everywhere.
I think for myself, the role of the defense attorney is to hold the government accountable. And if that means a guilty person goes free, I'm okay with that trade, because I think society has benefited when the government plays by their rules first, and then that trickles down to the citizens.
I agree wholeheartedly, Noah. That's probably why you and I are...
We're working together?
Yeah.
Yeah. I only have guests on this show that agree with me. If there's any dissension at all... If there's any dissension at all, you're gone. You're out. Your podcast, it's burning right now. It's just ashes. But I guess my question is, did you always feel that way? What was the philosophy in the prosecutor's office with these scofflaws, these criminals?
You know, the only time I remember sort of that coming up for me was the Anne Marie Gordon issue.
Why don't you explain that?
I think it was maybe 2007. The director of the state toxicology lab got into trouble because she basically falsified certain documents that verified she participated in certifying simulator solutions, when in fact she herself did not actually participate in certifying those simulator solutions. Eight other toxicologists did. They all signed off on it as well. And I don't know so much there was a question of, are these numbers accurate? The simulator solution is what's used to verify the breath test instrument. The question was, did Anne Marie Gordon commit perjury when she signed off on these documents? And at the time, when I worked for the prosecutor's office, I remember feeling kind of, who the F cares? Okay, she signed off on it. She didn't do it. That's shitty of her to have done, and maybe she should lose her job. But at the time, the judges were suppressing the breath tests for any case that Anne Marie Gordon signed off on. Even though eight other state-certified toxicologists had verified the same numbers, and I remember feeling, this just isn't right. And I remember being confronted by defense attorneys who said, don't you have a problem with this? Don't you think this is really terrible? And why aren't you just off out of the gate offering a deal on this? And I remember feeling like, it's not that big of a deal. Maybe she shouldn't keep her job, but it doesn't mean the numbers aren't right. So in a circumstance like that, yeah, my perspective would definitely change. That
Why is it so bad? Because you're right. The breath tests were probably accurate, and they were driving drunk. And this woman was lying under penalty of perjury, but the data was correct, albeit the person who created the data was, you know, not right. So why is that wrong now?
Well, if the director of that state lab feels emboldened enough to commit perjury each and every time she signs off on a simulator solution, then I worry about the quality and the character of each of the other toxicologists who have signed off on that. And if there's a culture and a tolerance for forging and fudgery, then maybe there is a much bigger problem. And it's sort of a perspective change, I guess, in that the government needs to be held to a much higher standard. It's not just, 98% good enough. If the government is going to introduce certain evidence at trial, and if the government is going to make accusations against someone in the efforts to curtail their liberty, then they need to be 100% above board, 100% on point. And we can't tolerate that in sort of reasonable courtroom behavior.
I think a lot of the civilian / demos that are listening, would think 98% is pretty good. 98% criminals go, you know, are guilty, and then the 2% maybe get caught up in the net. But then you told a story, two stories, about people you know or know of that went to jail. They were arrested. And it happens to you or to people you know that they are thrown in jail. And like you said, that time doesn't come back. So if these guys are fudging records and getting innocent people you know, loved ones, swept up, you know, in their nets of incarceration, that is a problem. Because
it's a huge problem, and even just misdemeanor convictions can impact a person's employability.
Oh, yeah.
Can impact a person's ability to apply for financial aid, their ability to apply for public housing and different resources.
We all have stories of people who lost their apartments, lost their job because of a misdemeanor conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Jobs are tight right now, and it's very easy for an employer to say, I've got two equally qualified candidates, except one was convicted of trespassing in 2000, the other one wasn't. I'm going to take the one that doesn't have a criminal record.
Yep.
Even something innocuous, it can really affect people for years and years. Is there any other tips or any other thoughts that you've had as a prosecutor now that you're on the side of Angels that you want to share with our audience?
I just wish that prosecutors would follow in my footsteps and just be fucking nice, because it doesn't have to be this adversarial. It doesn't have to be this unpleasant. We're all going to see each other again in court. Let's just figure out a way not to be douchey to one another.
So do you think you're kind of a modern-day Christ figure?
Oh, well, not kind of. Yeah. I mean, obviously.
The second coming as mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good to know.
Let's end it on I'm Christ.
On humility.
Let's end it with position of humility.
Which Christ advocated for, so it's worked out great. Well, Denise, thank you for joining us and sharing your incredibly arrogant views on how society should work. I think we all learned a lot.
Yes, I appreciate the opportunity you've given me to educate the public at large and to sort of christen them with my ideas and thoughts and perspectives. Thank you for that, Noah.
It's my pleasure. And if this worked out, we'll do this again.
Sounds great.